Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. The elections last week were a stunning rebuke to Trump and the Republicans, with Democrats winning in elections all across the country. Is the tide turning? Will Democrats be able to take back the House and Senate next year? Does the energy unleashed by Trump have the potential to realign our country? Our guest today has been very active in the state of Maine. Taryn Hull Weaver is the director of the Maine People's Alliance. She will talk with us about the amazing results of the recent election in Maine and what it means for we the people. But first, a word about what just happened today in Congress. The Republicans in the House passed a terrible tax bill, and they're trying to ram it through the Senate as soon as possible. The bill is a real disaster. It gives huge tax breaks to big corporations and the super rich, and actually raises taxes on millions of people in the middle class. It will explode the national debt. It will dramatically increase the already huge gap between the super rich and everyone else. It will drive a stake through the heart of middle class America. Some of the elements of the bill, which a lot of people don't know about, is it will increase the national debt by about $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years just to give tax breaks to the already rich. It will eliminate the estate tax on assets up to $11 million per person or $22 million per couple. It gives huge tax breaks to big business. It caps the home mortgage deduction at $500,000, cutting it from the current threshold of $1 million. That's going to hurt homeowners, realtors, and home builders. For most Americans, their home is their major asset. For many, it's our only asset. This Republican tax bill will also hurt millions of seniors by taking away the popular medical deduction, which allows people with high medical expenses to reduce their income taxes. It will eliminate the deduction on all local and state taxes. People are going to lose the ability to deduct our property and other taxes from our federal tax, affecting 44 million people. It eliminates the student loan interest tax deduction, making it even harder for moderate income individuals to make ends meet and afford their degrees. It hurts small businesses in many, many ways, and will further make an unlevel playing field so it will be more favorable terrain for big business. Small business owners may lose their ability to deduct many of their expenses, and it's going to make our taxes so complicated we're going to have to all hire help to figure out our new tax situation. After the Republicans explode the national debt with this big tax giveaway to the rich, I'm sure the next step will be taking a sledgehammer to programs like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and more. They will have a lot of slashing in the budget to do to pay for their $1.5 trillion tax breaks for big corporations and the super rich. They are going to really exacerbate the big gap between the top percent and the rest of us. So we all must take action. We all must call our two senators today and tell them to vote against this tax break for the rich bill. It is a big, big problem, and we must stop it. We stopped the health care travesty they tried to ram through, and we won that fight. We can win this fight, too. Now, on to what's happening in Maine. Taryn Hull Weaver is with the Maine People's Alliance, and she's here with us today. Taryn Hull Weaver, welcome to All Together Now.
Great to be on the show.
Yeah, so happy to have you here. Well, I saw you speak at a conference in Washington recently, and I went, we have to have this woman on our show, so I'm sure you're going to inform and entertain our listeners here. First up, why don't you tell us about the Maine People's Alliance. What's the purpose of the group?
Sure. Well, first off, I don't want to set too high an expectation for being interesting and entertaining here, but I'll do my best. So the Maine People's Alliance is Maine's largest citizen action group. We've got 32,000 members across the state, and for a state with just over a million people, pretty impressive number. And I'm actually not the director. I'm the legislative director of the organization. And
I gave you a promotion.
Thank you. And we really wake up every morning thinking about how are we shifting power from the already wealthy who've got a lot of it to people who don't have a lot of power, and what does it take to do that? And I'm thrilled to be on so we can talk about the big win that we just experienced in Maine when voters overwhelmingly approved Medicaid expansion last Tuesday, first in the country to do it by the ballot, and how the year before we raised wages for 1 in 3 Mainers, also by the ballot, and funded education by taxing the wealthy, also through the ballot. And we've done this all under Governor LePage, who's been called America's worst governor, America's craziest governor, and is sort of like a mini version of Trump, and kind of wrote the Trump playbook in many ways. So I'm excited to share lessons of what we've learned under LePage's rule in Maine and how they apply to the rest of the country.
Absolutely. That's exactly what we need to know. And you've done an amazing job there. Let's start with the big win on Tuesday. And on the ballot was about expanding Medicaid. Tell us exactly what the issue was in front of the people, and tell us what the vote was on Tuesday.
Sure. So your listeners will probably remember that one of the compromises of the Affordable Care Act under President Obama was that states could opt in or out of expanding Medicaid. And Maine was one of the states with a Tea Party Republican governor that said, no way. And we, as Maine People's Alliance, along with other allied organizations, have fought hard for Medicaid expansion, and we passed it through the legislature 5 times. And 5 times, Governor LePage vetoed Medicaid expansion, and then 5 times we very narrowly failed to override a veto because it takes 2/3, and it's just a pretty steep climb in divided government to get over that threshold. So this past year, going into the last stretch of the LePage administration, we knew we had to do something, and we put together a coalition to get Medicaid expansion on the ballot and take it right to the people. And so on Election Day last year, on the same day that we passed our ballot initiative to raise the minimum wage in Maine, which passed by historic margins, and pass another ballot initiative to fund public education through a tax on the wealthy, we collected, through volunteers, 65,000 signatures in 1 day to put Medicaid expansion on the ballot. And then,
wow,
of course,
that's impressive.
On that same night, it was a really impressive effort.
And the idea here is that if something passes in a ballot initiative where the voters themselves actually vote for a ballot initiative, that has immediate power. So the governor can't veto that, right? That's the voice of the people.
That's exactly right. So we took it to the people because voters in Maine, under our citizens initiative statute, have the power to pass law just like legislators do. And it can't be vetoed by the governor. So it was, you know, after five really valiant efforts and folks holding vigils at the State House and just incredible organizing around the state that wasn't cracking the code, it was time to take it to the next level. So we collected all these signatures in 1 day, and then that same night, Donald Trump was elected president.
And oh, God, what a day.
So it was a really hard night and a really mixed night because we had just won big in our ballot initiatives and we had just collected enough signatures in 1 day to get on the ballot, and at the same time felt, you know, so rocked and devastated and afraid at the prospect of what was going to happen to our country. And in the immediate aftermath of the election, there were a number of organizations and individuals that cautioned against going forward with Medicaid expansion at the ballot. And the rationale was Trump's president now, and he's demanding a full repeal of the ACA on his desk on January 20th, and voters aren't going to take seriously this attempt to expand Medicaid if we repeal the Affordable Care Act. And we pushed forward anyway, and we did so for two reasons. One was we knew there was a moral imperative for us to do so. 157 Mainers lose their lives, die every year because they don't have access to health insurance. And
how many? How many Mainers?
157.
157 Mainers. And the state has, what did you say, a million population?
Yeah, and there are between 70 and 80,000 Mainers that fall in the coverage gap and don't have access to basic health insurance. And so the first thing going through our minds was we just have to do this, and the election doesn't change that. And then the second thing is what we saw on election day in so-called white working class towns and cities across the state was voters coming in wearing red Make America Great Again hats and signing the petition to expand Medicaid. And we know there's a contradiction in terms when it comes to Trump voters who are economically insecure and voting for a man who, just as you outlined, is ready to pass a tax budget to hurt all of them. And we know that if we fight on the issues, we can win. So not in spite of Trump, but because of Trump, we felt like we even more so had to go through with this. And, you know, in hindsight is 2020, but it turns out it was a lot harder than Republicans thought to take health care away from 20 million people. And they have failed time and time again. And the movement's gotten stronger. And we just 59% to 41% passed Medicaid expansion and are sort of leading the nation now. So I just think there's such a political lesson in this moment of pushing ahead. And when there's a certain, political class offering caution, that it might even be more of a reason to go forward with something.
Well, I think you just said one of the most important things for all of us to learn about American politics and government right now. And that is that a lot of the people who voted for Trump, the white working class, like you said, with their Make America Great Again hats, are there signing the petition for the Medicaid expansion. That I think a lot of Americans felt that, our whole system is so geared to help the very rich that they saw Trump as a disruptor who could go in and kind of shake things up and actually work on behalf of working people. Now, sadly, we thought then, and we know now it's true, he was misleading them and did a lot of false advertising and kind of a big con job. But I think the message that he was sending that people resonated with is, I can go to D.C. and fix this. I can stop these bad trade deals and make sure that the working people get taken care of. And good for you for seeing that in that moment when it was looking so dismal that there was still hope for America and that you could actually ride the same wave that Trump rode, except you can do it with a genuine ballot initiative that's genuinely going to help improve their lives.
Yeah, thank you, Eleanor. I mean, that's exactly right. And it's a ballot initiative that we ran centered around the experiences and stories of directly impacted people. So the woman named Kathy Phelps, who was one of the stars of the TV ads, who's a hairdresser from Central Maine who needs oxygen to live and has fallen into the coverage gap and has just an incredibly powerful story, was the centerpiece of our communications. And so
explain a little bit, what do you mean when you say coverage gap?
Coverage gap of people who can't access affordable health care because their income is a little too high, but they're still, you know, struggling to make ends meet and still need subsidized health insurance.
That's a big constituency there, and I think Trump really tapped into that, that, you know, there are people who have just a little bit too much to qualify for all the programs that are designed for poor and low-income people, but they're not anywhere near a solid middle-class level where they can afford to pay all their bills. That is a huge chunk of America right now, and the class slippage that's happened between the solid middle class and kind of lower income and poor people. I mean, we saw a lot of that drop in 2007, 2008, instead of a march forward to ever more wealthy, bigger middle class. We've been going the wrong way. We've been going people in the middle class kind of slipping down. There's a lot of people in what you're calling here the coverage gap. They're not rich enough to pay all the bills, but they have too much of an income to qualify for the poverty programs.
Yep, that's right. So I think there's this, you know, there's the statistics that we're talking about right now, and then there's the stories. And we've worked really hard in Maine to run campaigns around real people's real stories because they're powerful and they move people. And I just have to believe as a community organizer that sharing stories across difference is the way we beat back and win against the politics of hatred and division.
Mm-hmm. That is great. And have you found it's really it's sharing the stories of real life people and how these programs actually help them? Is that more powerful than statistics, or do you use both stories and statistics to in your messaging to reach people?
Well, I can't remember who said this. Someone from the Obama campaign would always say, you want to get people's heads nodding and their hearts pumping. So it's a little bit of both. But the trap, I think, that campaigns and elected officials and advocates fall into is relying too heavily on the facts and figures and not leaning on stories enough. And when I think about this age of misinformation that we're all, like, this thick soup we're all wading through right now, a person-to-person interaction or a story that resonates with someone that they can relate to and see themselves connected with is, in my mind, the most important and the most powerful way to push back against the rhetoric of misinformation.
Very good. Yeah, I think the combination of stories and statistics is very powerful because the stories open our hearts and the statistics can convince our rational mind. So good for you for doing both.
And the important point I want to make, Eleanor, is that they have to be connected to a real campaign. And by a real campaign, I mean something that people are going to vote for. There's going to be a result. And other elected officials are going to have to respond to. So, you know, things like polling and public debates and just putting stuff out on Facebook, while it might, you know, help reach an end, is not actually a vehicle. So I just think there's a lot of talk right now in this, you know, sort of age of Trump-style social media about what tools we have and what we're fighting back with. And I think the most important thing to remember is you need a real vehicle where citizens are going to vote, elected officials are going to vote. Like, it's a real thing that people have to affirmatively respond to where there's an actual result.
Right, exactly. Well, good for you. So here you are when the rest of us are in massive depression with Trump ascending to the White House and the Republicans controlling all three, you know, of the centers of power in Washington, the White House, the U.S. Senate, and the U.S. House. Here you are marching off, collecting signatures for the next battle. And you got the stories, you did the messaging, you got a major issue that really matters about expanding Medicaid to cover people who are too rich to qualify for Medicaid but not wealthy enough to pay all the bills. And what happened in that race?
Well, the opposition, which was sort of the normal cast of characters of Governor LePage and Republicans and Chamber of Commerce, put together the same sort of using strategic racism, race baiting, poor people scapegoating campaign. And it wasn't enough. They put out an ad at one point saying that this was going to hurt seniors and attacking us, and it turned out that ad backfired on them. So they kind of threw everything they could, but we had public opinion on our side and used some really powerful stories and knocked on a bunch of doors. And so we just won big. And on the same day that we won big last Tuesday, we actually collected more than half the signatures we need for next year's ballot initiative. So we're on a real roll here in Maine. First up, minimum wage and education funding, and then Medicaid. And the next frontier is senior care for all, which will establish a universal in-home care guarantee for all aging seniors in Maine and people with disabilities and veterans.
Wow, that's a lot. Let's unpack this amazing agenda that you're unrolling here so successfully in the wonderful state of Maine. First, tell us the results on Tuesday on this Medicaid expansion ballot measure. What was the vote on Tuesday? How much did you win by?
59-41. So it was fairly a landslide in the right direction.
Fantastic. So you had, like, what's that, a 16-point spread? 18-point spread?
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And that's in the face of an absolutely crazy Governor LePage. I mean, he's just, like, some people think he might be certifiably mentally ill. But certainly, you know, using the race baiting and all the techniques we've seen with Trump at the national level, he's been doing in Maine for a while. But you beat that all back, and you won big time, 18-point spread. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. And we worked really closely with the Maine Equal Justice Partners and Planned Parenthood, who are two other wonderful organizations in Maine, and there was a team of directly impacted women led by a friend and colleague of mine, Kate Brennan, whose stories were really central to the campaign and were part of strategic planning conversations and mobilizing other citizens, and so it was just a terrific team effort all around.
Fantastic. So now, when does the Medicaid expansion take place that you just passed by ballot?
So now that we've passed it into law, there's a certain implementation schedule that's on a federal calendar that goes into effect. And Governor LePage wasted no time in inserting himself into the news stories coming out of the successful election and saying that he'll refuse to implement Medicaid and he'll veto it. And he actually can't do that under law. So he's really become an expert at making situations about himself and lying to the press. And so that was not a big surprise. And there's legal recourse in place if he either doesn't certify the results of the election or doesn't fill out the state kind of paperwork for expanding or doesn't issue benefits. And so Maine Equal Justice Partners, one of the terrific organizations I mentioned that was one of the leads on this campaign, has a shop of lawyers, and they are prepared to sue if needed. So the good thing about this going through the ballot is it's kind of in motion now, and Governor LePage can't just not implement it.
Fantastic. So congratulations on a huge win. Very, very well done. And I'm wondering, when did you join with the Maine People's Alliance? How long have you been legislative director there?
I've only been with MPA for a couple years. I've worked with MPA both as a volunteer and in sort of coalition capacity for a number of years. Mm-hmm. So it kind of feels like longer, but it's only been a couple years for me personally. The organization's been around since the early 80s, so coming up on 40 years.
So you were there, though, in the campaigns for minimum wage and education that were, you know, the last election, right?
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about the minimum wage. What was that ballot initiative about? What were you saying? Is this the $15 an hour minimum, or what were you pushing for?
Not quite. The minimum wage ballot initiative came out pretty similarly to Medicaid expansion after years of inaction by the legislature. And the policy took Maine's minimum wage, which before this law passed in 2016 was $7.50 an hour, up to $9 an hour, effective January of last year, and then added $1 per year until we will reach $12 an hour in 2020, at which point the minimum wage will rise along with the cost of living. There's an indexing that happens. So it's not $15, but still thousands of dollars more in the pockets of working people in Maine every year. So probably moved more money to Maine families through that one ballot initiative than any wins we've had in, you know, last 10 years. So that was huge. And then one other piece.
I think that's awesome. And by the way, you know, there's this whole national movement towards 15 or fight, get the $15 an hour minimum wage. And I actually think it, you know, that's a good generic goal, but there are places where that's not a good idea. So if you're in Washington, D.C. or New York or Boston, you know, yeah, you got to go towards that $15 an hour to be able to pay the rent and buy some food. But if you're living in Oklahoma or Maine, it's not the same scale. And if you do push on the $15 an hour in places like that, I think there is an argument, you know, that that could hurt the small businesses that are there, and you get kind of more pushback on it. So I think you were very sensible to go, if you're starting at $7.50 an hour, move it up to $9 an hour. That's a nice wage boost there. And then phasing it in at a dollar more a year, up to $12 an hour, and then very smart to index it to the you know, future rising, so you don't have to keep doing a ballot initiative every few years. You can actually, you know, it's automatically built in that you've got a lift to rise with the cost of living. So very well done. And how did that vote turn out?
So that vote turned out quite well. More voters voted to raise the minimum wage than had ever voted for a ballot initiative in Maine's history.
And wow. How many was that? Like, you know, how many people or what percentage it was?
400,000 something in Maine. So we were in the 55% range. And 82,000 more Mainers voted to raise the minimum wage than voted for Donald Trump. More people voted for the ballot initiative than either presidential candidate. So it's kind of this fascinating nexus. And then an important piece of the policy, besides raised wages for everyone on that yearly basis and then by indexing, was an eventual phase out of the subminimum wage for tipped workers who are paid half of the minimum wage that other workers receive and then have to rely on tips otherwise.
Yeah.
And this is a campaign that's being pushed for across the country. It's part of Bernie Sanders' plan that's moving through the Senate. And we worked closely with some of those same folks who have been working with national partners and states like Minnesota, Alaska, that have already phased out the subminimum wage. And unfortunately, the year following the ballot initiative win, so this past legislative session, legislators rolled back that piece of the policy, and it was a pretty disappointing and unfortunate result coming out of it. But we knew it was going to be, you know, going to be a hard fight going in, and it was. And I think there's a long term fight to be had over that one.
So you're saying the Maine legislature rolled back the subminimum wage increase for the tipped workers?
Correct. And the legislature also rolled back the tax increase on the top 2% of wealthiest households in Maine. So there were a couple just disappointing immediate rollbacks that I think, you know, voters in Maine have been pretty upset about. And one of the lessons, I think, of this past Tuesday's election, which saw big turnout and an off-cycle election and a sort of doubling down by voters in terms of their faith in the ballot initiative process, was that, you know, one legislative year of rollbacks isn't enough to diminish people's enthusiasm in the process and the change that voters are demanding inside or outside the legislature.
Mm-hmm. Well, now I need to get clarity on this. I thought was when a ballot initiative was passed, that's like the final word and the governor can't veto it. But you're saying the legislature could overturn it?
Yeah, so that's an important little layer of complexity, but the legislature can change any law at any time, and voters have the authority to pass laws. Governor can't veto a ballot initiative outright, but if the legislature takes action to modify or repeal it, that's where a change can come into play.
Okay, and we're going to be okay with the Medicaid expansion because the legislature already voted to increase it a couple of times, and so they were happy to have the ballot initiative backing them up, which the governor can't veto.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's mostly it, that the legislature has already passed this five times, and I do think the other piece of it is that there's an understanding that voters in Maine are pretty upset right now with what happened to the recent referenda results. Uh-huh. And so I hope and expect that there's a sense among legislators that, especially in the year before an election, it's just not that politically smart to try to take health care away from people when voters just overwhelmingly approved it and are already pretty upset about previous results getting overturned.
Right. Very good. So you got the minimum wage passed last time. You got the Medicaid expansion passed this time with a whopping good, healthy margin. And you also had a ballot initiative on education. Tell us what that battle was about.
Yeah, so that one was also a 2016 initiative, and it came out of a threat by Governor LePage that he was going to put on the ballot a repeal of Maine's income tax altogether and put in place a bunch of so-called welfare reforms that are really just, vehicles for scapegoating poor people. And we reacted to that and thought, gosh, if the governor's going to have this horrendous ballot initiative in front of voters, we've got to respond. And we put together an initiative to raise funding for public education so that the state of Maine could meet its obligation to funding our local schools and do so by raising taxes on the wealthy. Because when Governor LePage first took office in 2010, he was one of five Tea Party governors who was elected during that red wave, along with Scott Walker from Wisconsin and Ohio, Kansas, North Carolina, to pass sweeping tax cuts for the wealthy. Uh-huh. And Maine, along with those other four states, have been the five slowest to recover from the economic recession. So it's just been this clear-cut lesson of trickle-down economics does not work. The Kansas legislature, with Republican control, repealed the tax cuts for the rich this past year, and voters in Maine kind of beat them to it because we did it at the ballot box last November through this initiative. By the way, Governor LePage failed to collect even enough signatures to get on the ballot. So he didn't even make it onto the ballot, but we won that one. And then in the legislature, as I said, the final compromise on the budget ended up repealing the 3% surcharge on incomes over $200,000, which was the wealth tax initiative. So
let's just so I'm clear here, you had your own ballot initiative about education, and it was to increase funding for the local schools, and that would be paid for by putting a 3% tax on the people with over $200,000 a year income. Is that right?
Yep, that's right.
And then how did that vote go in that ballot initiative in last year in 2016?
You know, I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but we won, and we won in particular. We won particularly in places where so-called white working class voters live and where Democrats have been losing ground. So we saw this trend of the economic populist ballot referenda succeeding in places where Hillary Clinton lost and where Democrats have been losing ground.
Uh-huh.
And because we came out the other end of the legislature with a bunch more funding for public education in the budget, which was great and wouldn't have been possible without that ballot referenda, but having lost ground on the tax on the wealthy, we know we need to give it another shot. And we've just seen this tremendous disconnect between what voters want and what the public wants, and then what feels like a political possibility to those in the Capitol. And we this is a trend we kind of see across the country. I'm speaking on a panel tomorrow. I'm back down in D.C. at the Center for Budget Priorities and Policy Conference. And I'm on a panel with a woman, Vanessa Williams, who's with the Brookings Institute, who's done research for 6 years on how Americans are really proud to pay taxes. And there's this myth that Americans hate taxes. So there's a big disconnect between the myth successfully perpetuated by the right and the reality of what voters want. And in Maine, we sort of see the same thing where voters just approve taxing the wealthy. And we know from poll after poll that it's incredibly politically popular to talk about taxing the wealthy. But then, within the walls of the state house, there's an unpopularity among it. So we got to keep moving, real campaigns and real vehicles to prove this is something that voters want. And so our home care initiative for the 2018 ballot, is paid for by, in part, busting the cap on Social Security taxes, which are some of the most regressive in the country. So for people who earn over $127,500, which would put them in the top 5% of wealthiest Mainers, they'll pay a little bit more since they're not paying into Social Security, that will go to making sure that all Mainers can age at home with dignity and independence.
Fantastic. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about that upcoming ballot initiative that you just got signatures for on that senior care for all and the dignity of staying at home. That's so important. I want to talk a little bit now about what you've learned in Maine that could be lessons for people around the country, because I think there is kind of this myth of, Trump is so strong and the Republicans are winning in the not only in Congress but also in the state houses. But you're showing a pathway of how, in spite of all that's happening with that, that we can actually win on these initiatives that help improve people's lives. So tell us a little bit, what do you think Maine can show the rest of the world about how we win in the Trump era?
I think that's a great question. And there are a couple lessons I'd point to. One is that the best defense is a strong offense.
Uh-huh.
And when LePage was first elected, we were just so on the defense. And it took, a couple years of being just in the trenches and holding on to programs and policies for us to kind of get ahead of ourselves and advance an alternative vision and set of policies. And then it took us another cycle to figure out the legislature was not where we were going to make change. And we had to pursue another path forward. And that's when we first collected signatures to get on the ballot to raise the minimum wage. And now we've been on a roll passing ballot initiatives. And what we've seen is that we can control the debate and we can push back against LePage just having total, open stage, open mic to say whatever racist scapegoating things he wants to say. And one good example of that is the difference between the budget fight this past year and the year before. Two cycles ago, the budget fight in the legislature was dominated by so-called welfare reform. And if you just look up headlines from that year, at least half of the headlines were about welfare fraud and how we can crack down on the problem. And even Democrats were holding press conferences about cracking down on welfare fraud. I mean, it was just, not in a good frame for us. In this past year, if you look at headlines from Portland Press Herald and Bangor Daily News, the state's two major newspapers, and listen to the Maine Public Broadcasting Network and the radio, you read headlines about funding education and taxing the wealthy and a debate about how much we should be taxing the wealthy. So it's just this like complete, we had just changed the four corners of the debate and changed it entirely. So that's the first lesson, is that the best defense is a strong offense. And the second lesson is related, and it's about focusing on issues and not personality. And when Governor LePage ran for re-election, I think it was a mistake for many progressives to think there was, he had a ceiling of support. Like there are only so many people who would possibly vote for him again. And it's because he was, you know, crazy and said flamboyant things. And the campaign run by the Democrat who went up against him in 2014 really focused on his negative image. And I think there's a similar dynamic that played out on the national stage, where the Clinton campaign really focused on Trump's negatives. And people are struggling right now, and people are looking for answers and for a vision on a path forward. And I think if we can stay really steady on our own vision and on the issues, then that's how we win. And I don't think it means, you know, we don't confront the blatant racism and misogyny of some of these elected leaders, but I think it's about us, you know, standing strong on our own two feet about the change we need right now.
I think that's really important. And I remember right after Trump won in 2016, there was a great op-ed from someone in Italy, and they were talking about a similar man had come out of business. He was a billionaire. He was, you know, a little wild and woolly like Trump, unpredictable and kind of a strong, almost a fascist sort of tendency in the way he was dealing with things. And this Italian wrote an op-ed to the American people, and he said, look, you know, you're dealing with a guy similar to what we were dealing with. Learn from us what we did that worked, and it does not work to focus on personality and criticizing his negative personality traits. What works is focusing on the key issues and what is he doing that's, you know, hurting or helping you on key issues, and what are better ways to move forward. So I'm just underscoring what you're saying is so incredibly important. Focus on the issues, not on the personality.
Yep. Yeah, and there was a great piece in the Washington Post a couple of days ago about how voters who voted for Trump in old Rust Belt towns where manufacturing jobs have left and he promised to bring them back and he hasn't are still very loyal to him. And, you know, people attach to personalities and identity and then tend to shift their policy positions to support whatever that person supports. So there's just only so much you can do to attack the individual, but it's like we got to work around him. And we know, you know, in some of those same places, voters voted for Bernie Sanders by hugely lopsided margins and then went for Trump. So clearly there is this economic populist path forward. And the question is it a path that's inclusive and going to fight for an equitable and fair future for all of us? Or is it a path that's going to fight for a future that's good for the wealthy at the expense of everyone else? It's like fake populism.
Right, exactly. And by the way, I'm just curious, is the Maine People's Alliance taking any action on trying to stop this Republican tax bill that's running in Congress right now? Or, you know, we know Senator Susan Collins is a Republican, but she actually was a key vote in stopping the horrendous health care bill that they tried to ram through. But it sounds like you're focusing more on the state level than on the federal.
Well, actually, we've done quite a bit this year, well, and for a long time on the federal level, in putting a tremendous amount of grassroots pressure on Susan Collins around healthcare votes in particular, doing a lot of accountability on Representative Bruce Poliquin's record. He is the second congressional district, Northern Maine representative, and he's essentially a Wall Street fat cat and doesn't represent Northern Maine at all. And he, I'm just looking at Facebook right now, he just voted for the terrible tax bill. And so we've been out there with small businesses and folks across the state trying to shine a spotlight on this and their upcoming votes. And we'll definitely have to do some accountability now that we see that Poliquin voted the wrong way.
Yeah. All right, good. Well, I'm glad you're focusing on that. And then another piece that strikes me about lessons learned is the importance of progressive organizations to come together and collaborate. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about the organizations that are involved in the Maine People's Alliance, because you've got an impressive roster of groups that are active in the Alliance. How many groups do you have, and how do you get everybody to work together and rowing in the same direction?
Well, so Maine People's Alliance is, we're just one organization, and we work in really close partnership with other organizations, and it has been really important to be rowing in the same direction, and it's also been really important for groups that are typically pitted against each other on purpose by our opposition and by powerful wealthy interests to link arms and say we are stronger together. So in the state budget fights, for example, it took us a little while to get here, but we've built a coalition that's made up of state workers and teachers and groups like Maine People's Alliance and Maine Equal Justice Partners that represent low-income Mainers and Mainers with disabilities and Maine seniors and AFL-CIO, so a lot of labor unions, Planned Parenthood, to all work together in the budget so that when it comes time for inevitably Republicans to say this is the false choice ahead of you and present a false dichotomy that we either can fund schools or HHS programs or, you know, asylum seekers are on the chopping block or women are on the chopping block, that we say, no, none of those things are acceptable, and that's not a true choice that we have to make. And it took us deliberately working together to deepen our shared analysis and build power together and approach a budget fight united with linked arms to really make a difference. So I think that is when Republicans want to divide and conquer, we can't fall into that trap and let it happen. We have to build the infrastructure and alliances that allow us to be brave in that moment and stand by each other and say no.
Yeah, that's great. You know, united we succeed, divided we fail. So, you know, hats off to you for working in partnership with so many wonderful groups there in Maine. And how are you dealing in Maine with the big block that so many activists bump up against around the country is, you know, the Koch brothers' money, the right-wing money, you know, the whole, the groups that are trying to push their right-wing libertarian agenda all across the country. Are you experiencing them in Maine? And if so, and what are you doing to overcome them?
Yeah, I mean, we are, and we've done a lot in the last couple of years to really shine a spotlight on bills that are derived from ALEC or money that's coming into the right-wing think tank group in Maine, right from the Koch brothers. And one of the ways we've done that is to create our own earned media news site, and it's called the Maine Beacon. You can go to mainebeacon.com to check it out. And actually, let me check my computer, make sure it's not mainebeacon.org. But there is mainebeacon.com. I was right. There's the primary right-wing think tank in Maine is called the Maine Heritage Policy Center, and it's sort of like cookie-cutter, ALEC, Koch brothers organization, and they have their own website called the Maine Wire that publishes, like, you know, really not real news stories. And I think conservatives were really on the leading edge of, like, figuring out sort of digital manipulation. And when we realized this was a problem, we thought there's a real need to get, you know, our kind of side of the story and to share people's stories and talk about what's happening in Augusta. So we started the Maine Beacon, and it's now the most viewed and shared news site at the state level in the country. So we've made just incredible strides, and we'll put up articles that can get, you know, 2,000, 10,000 or more shares on Facebook to really spread the word about progressive campaigns and what's at stake. So that's been an important tool for us. And part of the goal of Maine Beacon has been to really expose what's going on the other side. And I think, you know, we've not totally cracked the nut, but I think we've made some strides towards exposing where some of that money comes from.
That is totally awesome. I mean, that to me, that's the great American spirit, right? You're faced with the fake news of Fox News and Alec and the Koch brothers, and instead of just you know, throwing tomatoes at the TV, you set up your own wire service. I love it. Mainebeacon.com. I just put it up on my website as we're talking here, and it's really impressive. I can see why you're getting such good readership and sharing. It's fascinating. So hats off to you for that creative entrepreneurship.
Thank you. And we've got our own podcast called The Beacon that comes out on Friday mornings, and you can subscribe on iTunes or right on the website. But it's, you know, it's pretty niche because it's about Maine politics, but we also talk about what's going on at the national level, and it's pretty fun.
Wonderful. And I promise we'd talk about your plans coming up, and you did the same winning formula last week as you were bringing voters to the polls to pass the Medicaid expansion. You're gathering signatures for the next ballot initiative, and so coming up next is Senior Home Care for All. Tell us a little bit about what you see happening, the plans of the Maine People's Alliance for the 2018 elections.
Sure. So we'll talk about home care first and then 2018. So Maine's the oldest state in the country. And this initiative is about really fundamentally rethinking the way we care for our families and our aging parents and grandparents. There's a great podcast put out by Vox. That's the Ezra Klein Show. I don't know if you listen to that show, Eleanor. He interviews guests at length about different interesting topics.
Uh-huh.
And he had Ai-Jen Poo, who's the head of Caring Across Generations, the National Domestic Workers Alliance, and she's won a MacArthur Genius Award, and she's one of the real thought leaders and policy leaders on home care. And she was making the case that if you think about the future of work as robots and automation, you're doing it wrong, because really the future of work is about the future of care work in our country and how we're going to care for each other and whether our aged ones are going to get to stay at home and live in independence and age with dignity, and whether those jobs are going to be good paying jobs that can support workers taking care of their own families. And so in Maine, facing an increasingly aging population and thousands of families who just can't make ends meet because nursing homes are prohibitively expensive and home care is expensive, and contrary to popular belief, Medicare doesn't really cover it for most families. And you've got a shortage on the worker side of things because the jobs are just hard and wages are too low, and they're largely set by reimbursement rates, which are set through public funding. We've got this big problem to tackle. We're going to do so by saying this is actually a public good, and we're going to provide universal, guaranteed access to all Maine seniors who need help, and that means needing help with at least one daily assisted living activity, whether that's getting groceries or a little help getting dressed or showering or bathing. And home care workers will come to people's homes so they can age at home, which is what the vast majority of Mainers want to do, as opposed to go to a hospice center or a nursing home that's unfamiliar to them and away from their community and families, and that those workers will receive good training and better wages. And so we're also developing a workforce at the same time. So it's one of these policies that's both, you know, in some ways kind of groundbreaking and in other ways really common sense. And when we were standing out across polling locations with volunteers across the state on election day, we heard just the most really heartwarming and heart-wrenching stories from people, and heard from our volunteers about voters who reached across the table and hugged them for doing this, and shared stories of how challenging it was to have to send their parents and grandparents to nursing homes, or just struggle to make ends meet to take care of them in the way that they wanted to. And so we know this resonates in a really deep level for people, and feel really excited about taking this challenge that so many Maine families struggle with privately and sometimes shamefully, and just dragging into the light of day and saying, this is a public problem and we've got solutions at our fingertips and we're going to do something about it. So that's
fantastic.
Here.
Well, I think that's really critical, and maybe, you know, here again, Maine can show the way for the country that is having the oldest average age in the country. That, yes,
yep.
We need to rethink the care of our parents and grandparents. And, yes, who wants a robot? I mean, I'd rather have someone come into my house to give me whatever care I might need, or to parents. And as you say, this is maybe a common sense approach because, you know, really people want to stay in their homes. They don't want to go to these assisted living places or nursing homes. I've dealt with this myself with my own parents. But what's common sense is not common practice. And what you're doing is taking a very common sense and humane approach to the aging issue in our country and your state, and making a common practice that has heart and helps care for people in a very sensible way.
Yeah, yep.
So we just have 1 minute left, and before we sign off, I just want to know, you know, we've got some listeners living in Maine. We have other listeners from around the country who might want to learn from you and learn about your models. If our listeners are interested in learning more or getting involved, how do they contact you, or, you know, what do they do?
That's a great question. So my email is Taryn, T-A-R-Y-N, at MainePeople'sAlliance.org, and I'd love to hear from any of your listeners. And you can find Maine People's Alliance on Facebook, on Twitter. You can go to MaineBeacon.com to see what we're up to and listen to the podcast and follow us there. And I really believe that it's going to take a people's movement in Maine and in our country to turn the ship around. So welcome hearing from anyone who's already in the mix or wants to get in the mix and join the team.
Fantastic. And that's all the time we have. Taryn Hallweaver, Legislative Director of the Maine People's Alliance, thank you so much for being with us today and for helping to show the way forward for our country.
Thanks, Eleanor. I really appreciate talking with you and all your terrific questions.
We hope to have you back and give us an update on your great work.
Thank you. Maybe next year after we win Senior Care for All.
Yes, good luck.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next Thursday. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.